We're almost a third of the way through 30 days of Beyond the Grid, and welcome to day 10 with me, Tom Clarkson. It's a month to go until the first round of F1 Academy in Saudi Arabia, and 2024 will be a huge year for the series. F1 Academy aims to get female drivers ready to climb up the ladder to higher levels of competition by giving them more track time at different circuits, competitive racing, and all the physical and mental preparation to be at their very best. After its launch last year, 2024 is going to be bigger and better, with all 7 rounds taking place at Grand Prix weekends and all 10 Formula One teams supporting the series by providing drivers and liveries. Susie Wolf is the managing director of F1 Academy, and she knows all about the obstacles facing women on their motorsport journeys, having driven in Formula Renault, Formula 3, the DTM, and Formula 1 practice sessions. I sat down with Susie back in 2022 to talk about her racing career, going up against Lewis Hamilton in karting, what it was like to drive an F1 car for Williams, and helping to create opportunities for women and girls in racing. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Susie, it's lovely to have you on the show. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, look, there are so many strings to your bow, but let's start by talking about 2014, British Grand Prix, German Grand Prix. You're in the Williams. Just how do you reflect on all that now?
I look back and it seems like a completely different chapter in my life now, but one that I look back on fondly. I think I never made it to racing in Formula One, but just to drive those cars, to be part of such an iconic, great team like Williams, it's an opportunity that I'm eternally grateful for. And I still remember so clearly the pressure before those sessions, because when you're only doing an FP1, you want to show what you're capable of, but you're well aware that you cannot put a foot wrong because it could impact the team's performance over the weekend. So I don't miss the pressure, but I certainly loved driving those Formula One cars.
How much warning did you get ahead of, well, Silverstone came first, didn't it? So when did you get the nod that it was going to happen?
I knew early on in the year, and I have to say the team did a great job of preparing me well. I had a lot to prove to get the opportunity, and I was very diligent in my preparation because I knew an opportunity like that doesn't come across very often, and I had to grab it with both hands. So I knew very early on which racetracks I would be given the opportunity, and I knew exactly what I wanted to achieve.
Silverstone's not the easiest place to make your debut. Is it Copse at 180 miles an hour? Which were the toughest sections? Just talk to us about driving that FW36 around there.
It seems just like yesterday. I knew I had 2 runs in the session on new tyres, 1 of 4 laps, the next 1 of 4 laps. I did the first run, and obviously I was lucky in that you do a lot of preparation in the simulator. So I knew where I had to be braking. I knew the speeds I had to be carrying. We came in after that first run. I looked at the data. I was 9 tenths off, 6 tenths only in Copse Beckett's alone, the high speed stuff. And someone in the team at the time, one of the data engineers, were looking at the data. And I remember it so clearly. He looked at me and said, "You're just going to have to go back out there and nail it through Copse and Beckett's." And I looked at him and nodded and said, "Okay, I know what I got to do." And I went back out and I tried. You know, I tried to then just carry more speed. But the difficulty as a test driver, you're not in the car very much. And the minute you jump in, you need to immediately find the limit. So it was a huge challenge, but also so enjoyable. To drive an F1 car around the Silverstone Grand Prix circuit is something I will always treasure.
Let's talk about Copse, that 6 tenths. How much feedback do you get from the car, and how much of it is just looking at the data and hoping that it does what it says on the data?
Well, I'm someone that's very data driven. So if I can see that it's possible, I have no problem to overcome, let's say, that internal fear and say, okay, this is possible flat. And the great thing about Formula One cars, the faster you go, the more downforce you get. So you've just got to get over that mental barrier. And I do remember my second run, I approached Beckett's and I just said, I am not going to lift on the first part. I'm just going to keep the foot down. And I kept the foot down. The car went through the first part of the corner and I was like, okay, it's done. It's done. But it just is an incredible piece of machinery. And what it's capable of in the first few laps, you somehow can't even comprehend.
What did the engineers want from you in that free practice session? What was the brief as you went in?
Number one brief, do not under any circumstance crash the car, which I completely understand. But, you know, I had my supporters in the team also who were very keen for me to go out there and show what I could do. And I felt that. I felt a lot of support from within the team. And I obviously wanted to show what I could do. I didn't want to just be out there on track. I wanted to show that I was quick enough. So it was a balance between obviously pushing, but making sure I didn't crash the car.
What was Frank like to deal with in that situation? He always loved racing drivers, didn't he? His eyes lit up whenever he talked about racing. What did he say to you before and after?
I think after it was probably more just relief that the car was back in one piece and there wasn't any issues. But I was also lucky that Claire was playing quite a pivotal role in the team at the time, and she was very supportive, but she also expected performance. I mean, in the end, it didn't matter if I was a girl or not. When the helmet went on, I'd been given this great opportunity and there was an expectation that I would deliver.
Right, let's fast forward 2 weeks to Hockenheim. Did you almost feel better prepared for that? A, because you'd had the prior experience, but also because of DTM, you'd done a lot of miles around the track.
I'd done a lot more laps around Hockenheim than I'd done around Silverstone, which is maybe funny coming from a British driver, but that was my hunting ground in DTM, and I know that track so well, and I had been quite vocal in my support of me doing the FP1 at that track because I knew that it would be a good track for me. And there, I think for sure it was great to have had the British Grand Prix done, and I just went into that session knowing exactly what I wanted to achieve.
And boy, you did. I think you were, what, 2/10 off Felipe Massa?
Yeah, I would have liked to have been even closer, but I ended up only 2/10 off. And that was a session where I'd put a lap together that I felt was near to what I wanted it to be. And it ended up only being 2/10 off.
And when you look at the data, where did Massa have those 2/10 on you around that lap?
I know exactly. It was heading into after the Mercedes grandstand. I can't remember the corner number now. I think it's
so the right-hander after the Mercedes.
The fast right-hander. Yeah. It was the next turn 10 because there's the direct gravel trap with the barrier where actually Sebastian Vettel went off in the race. And I knew I had to carry a lot of speed in, but I also knew there was a risk that if I went in too hard, I was off into the gravel and probably into the tyre wall. And that's where I lost the 2/10.
Amazing. And although you'd got that DTM experience, does a Formula One car make it a completely different racetrack in a way?
Absolutely. The downforce that you have, the performance of the brakes, you know, your braking points are so much later in a Formula One car that it is a different track, but it still was an advantage for me having known the track so well.
The FW36 was a good car. Massa was on pole in Austria that year. Lots of podiums.
Those were some great, great races for Williams in that year. The car was strong. I mean, I don't have a comparison to tell you it was better or worse than another Formula One car I'd driven, but that car, it looked great in the Martini colours. It had the strong Mercedes powertrain in, and it did some great podiums that year.
Well, Valtteri finished second in both of the races where you did the FP1s. I attribute that to you and your preparation for Valtteri.
You said that, not me, but you know, I'll take it. I'll take it.
Now, Susie, I'm keen to know more about your driving style. How did you drive a car? How did you like to set it up? Did you like a bit more understeer, oversteer? What could you deal with more easily?
I hated understeer. I always loved to have a really strong front, even if it was too pointy, even if it made my rear a bit snappy. I was someone that just did not like understeer.
That's interesting, isn't it? Oh, is it Max Verstappen, I think, can deal. One of the reasons everyone says, oh, he can deal with the Red Bull a little bit easier than other people is because he can deal with a loose rear end, as could Michael Schumacher back in the day. So I would say that puts you in a category of drivers that's, well, there's more people that deal with understeer. I feel Coulthard's of this world example. He always used to say, I like a little bit of understeer, or of the two.
But I'm not sure, Tom, that I'm comfortable with you comparing me to Max Verstappen, because if I look back at my career, I'm incredibly proud of what I achieved, and I had a lot of tenacity and determination, but I wasn't one of the greats. Definitely not. I always lacked that couple of tenths that would have moved me from a mid-pack to a front pack. I had some difficult years in DTM. I think part of that was also the infrastructure where they had A team and B team. But I certainly, I think, did the best that I could with the talent I had. But I wasn't at the very top of the game.
But what about if you'd had more experience? I mean, how did you feel after those two runs? Hungry for more, I would imagine.
Absolutely hungry for more, without a doubt. You know, from being a little eight-year-old girl that dreamed of racing karts, and then at the age of 13 going to watch a Formula 3 race and suddenly realizing, wow, you can make a career out of this. You can be a racing driver and make it to Formula 1. And Formula 1 became my goal. And for such a big part of my life, every day I woke up, it was all focused on trying to get to Formula 1. I would have loved the opportunity to race in Formula 1. I got very close. But on the other side, I also recognized that I didn't have that talent that the very top drivers in Formula 1 have.
Did you have conversations with Williams and other teams about a race seat?
Unfortunately, there simply wasn't the opportunity. While I was at Williams, there was Felipe and there was Valtteri, and there was no question that driver lineup was going to be changed. And at the time, to get an opportunity in another team, it would have been a team at the very back. I was very, very clear with myself that I wouldn't pay a lot of money to do a race at the back of the grid, because that wasn't what my ambition was. And that's why in a way the decision to stop in 2015 was an easy one, because the journey had come to its natural end. I had done 3 years as a test driver. I knew every year that I stayed on the sidelines as a test driver, it was more unlikely that I would come back into a race seat, because I'd simply been out of the game for too long. And that's why it was an easy decision in the end.
Did you feel like a trailblazer?
No, I've never felt like a trailblazer. I've simply felt like a girl that was chasing her dream. And I'm honestly humbled to hear that that's inspired so many. And even today, coming into the track, young girls saying, you're an inspiration and I want to work in motorsport because of you. And it really is very humbling for me to hear that, because I never set out on a path to prove what a woman could do. I simply set out on my path and followed my passion.
When people say to you, why aren't there any female drivers racing in Formula One at the minute? Because there hasn't been anyone since you in 2014. Tatiana Calderon tested a Sauber a couple of years ago. But what is your answer to that?
I've spoken so much about women in motorsport and this particular topic that I sometimes feel that I've got nothing more to say. But I've obviously said, for me, it's about the talent pool. It's a numbers game. If you've only got a handful of little girls racing at top level European karting, it's very unlikely that one of them is going to make it to the very pinnacle of the sport. But if you've got more girls racing, the talent pool naturally becomes bigger, and the more chance you have of a girl making it to the very top. And I think the second part is also about inspiration. You've got to see it to believe it. And unfortunately, right now, we don't have a female driver in Formula One that can inspire the next generation. But I do believe, on the positive side, there are a lot of very talented women in the sport, maybe off track more than on track right now. And they are proving to be inspirations. And I've certainly seen it in my time in the sport that slowly but surely we're making progress.
So we need to get more young girls coming into karting, increase the pool in karting, and then we're more likely to end up with a female racing in Formula One. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I think you've got to increase the numbers of participation for the very talented to reach the very top. But in all of the work that I've done, I'm also quite passionate about increasing the overall environment of motorsport, because when you come to a Formula One race, there's 20 drivers on the grid, but you'll know better than me the numbers. There must be 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people between the teams and the Formula One infrastructure and the infrastructure at the racetrack involved in putting the event on. And I think we have a situation where motorsport has been seen as something very male dominated. And the more women we can get into the environment, the more diverse the sport will be. And that's got to be a positive for the long term.
Let's go back to Oban on the west coast of Scotland. All right, Susie.
So, great place. It's a great place for anyone that hasn't been there.
Well, it's a popular holiday resort, isn't it? For cycling, walking, scuba diving. Where did your desire for motorsport come from?
Well, I think
it's an unlikely backdrop.
It's an unlikely backdrop until you know my family story. My mum met my dad when she went to buy her first motorbike out of his shop, and they still run that same shop nearly 40 years later. My dad had a team in Isle of Man TT. He was a very keen racer. My mum sometimes raced bikes. Her father, so my grandfather, was quite a famous motocross rider in the 1950s. And I got a little bike for my second birthday, a little three-wheeler quad. And I was naturally one of these little girls that I loved speed. I loved adrenaline. I loved competition. So those character traits naturally, let's say, fitted the sport. And for my eighth birthday, I got a go-kart. People presume that I jumped in that little go-kart and was a natural talent, but I most definitely wasn't. I remember the first time we went out on track at Lark Hall, a circuit just outside Glasgow. And I was out on track and the carts were flying past me much quicker, and they were even kind of bumping me as they went past. And I came back into the pits and I said to my dad, I really don't like that out there. He said, no problem, Toots. That was his nickname for me. We got two options now. We put the cart back in the truck and we head home. Or you go back out there, you try and go faster. And when they hit you or bump you, you're going to bump them back twice as hard. So I think you can guess which option I went for. I went back out there and I loved the challenge. And before long, I was racing in the Scottish Championships, in the British Championships, and I qualified for the European Championships. And it was still only a hobby. And I'm very thankful to my parents when I look back, because I have an older brother, but I never remember thinking I was doing something unusual for a girl. My brother raced, so we kind of toured around as a family. But my parents never gave me the impression I was doing something unusual for a girl. And at 13, they took me to watch a Formula 3 race at Donington Park. Jackie Stewart had his team. Jenson Button won on that day. And that's when it really, the idea was born in my head that I wanted to be a racing driver. And that's when really everything changed, because it went from being just a hobby to something that I became very determined and focused on.
Can we just tidy up what was obviously a big family moot point? Who was quicker, you or your brother?
Depends who you ask. I'll say I was quicker. He'll say he was quicker. There were a couple of situations where we drove home in silence because we'd hit each other out on track. And I remember once my dad saying, please, kids, the race is over. Just talk to each other. But it was a good couple of days before we even muttered a word to each other because we were both so upset.
I'm interested that it was a go-kart and not a motorbike that your parents gave you.
My dad always said his little girl could race on four wheels, but not two. And I'm glad about that now. He lost one of his very dear friends in the Isle of Man TT. He's a huge fan of motorbikes, and obviously MotoGP and TT still, but he felt four wheels were safer, and I think he's right there.
Did you travel with him to the Isle of Man? Have you watched the racing there? Did you ever see Mum race?
I remember going to Isle of Man TT, the camping. I remember spending a lot of time at Knock Hill. That's where I tried a kart for the first time. My dad was racing, my mum sometimes too, and I would be badgering my dad. It was £5 for 15 minutes, and he never could give us enough £5. We always came back asking for more. But those were great memories and were a lot of fun as a family.
Now, in 2000, you were named the top female karter, I think, in the world at the time. You were racing some real household names now. Lewis Hamilton, was that in karting or was that in single-seaters? Was that both?
That was in that year when I was named as top female. We were, the World Championships were in Portugal. Kubica was on pole. It was Lewis. There was a lot of names now, Nico, that were in that race. And yeah, I finished 15th overall, which obviously I was quite proud of, but I wasn't on the podium. And they called my name over the tannoy saying, come to the podium ceremony. And I remember I was in a team with Lotta Hellberg and the Gillard carts, and we looked at each other thinking, oh no, I hope I'm not in trouble or going to be disqualified for some reason. We ran to the podium ceremony and I was called up on stage to receive the award for top female in the world. And I remember looking at Lotta and suddenly thinking to myself, I'm not here to be the top female. And then I suddenly thought, actually, are there actually any other girls in the competition? And I thought, okay, maybe I've seen two others. But I remember feeling very embarrassed in that moment that I had been singled out as a top female because I was there to try and win the race, not to be the top female. And I think at that time, you know, I was 18. It was the first realization for me that I was seen as different, that this was going to be different for me because I was seen as different. And I think, you know, the following year I tried to move into single seaters, and that's when the media attention really picked up on me being a girl. And I've said this many times, but I've only ever done one interview in my whole career where I wasn't asked about my gender, and it became such a big topic of my career.
What was life like as a woman in karting?
It's something I'm asked often, and it's quite hard for me to answer because obviously I only have my own experience. If I look back, yes, there were some very, very tough moments where I felt very lonely because I was definitely treated differently.
And while you were karting and racing the likes of Lewis and Paul de Resta, were you also doing other sports?
No, at the age of 12, I was in the school swim team and I was in the downhill ski team. Quite unusual to think that Scotland had its own ski team, but we did. We do get skiing sometimes in Scotland. And I remember it being very hectic all the time, to the point that my parents said, look, we're not going to do all three sports well. You've got to pick which one you really want to concentrate on. And it wasn't even a decision for me. It was clear that I wanted to focus on karting.
You've got a son now, Jack. Do you think it's unusual that you had such a clear idea what you wanted to do from such a young age? When you see your son now,
I look back and I'm just so thankful to my parents because they made it possible, but they never pushed me too hard. But they opened my eyes to possibilities. You know, I come from a very small town in the west coast of Scotland, and through sport, I've managed to travel the world, and I'm so grateful for that. But I do think that karting was only ever a hobby up until I got taken to that Formula 3 race. And for sure, they probably took me there thinking, we need to understand if this is really what Susie wants to do, or whether it's just going to stay as a hobby for us. But I was very driven. I am very driven. And that's sometimes, you know, not what you hear a woman saying, but I'm ambitious, I'm driven. And I had set my goal. I wanted to make it to Formula One, and I for sure sacrificed a lot, but for me it wasn't a sacrifice because I was doing what I loved and I enjoyed. I wouldn't say all of it. There were very, very tough moments along the way, but I'm very grateful to have done this sport for so long and to still be involved in this sport.
Let's talk about the step into single seaters, and particularly how much was your single seater career derailed by an ankle injury?
I think the ankle injury definitely derailed me, but actually not having enough sponsorship was the bigger issue, because I had done 2.5 years of Formula Renault, which we had funded partly through the family and partly through sponsors. And I had been nominated for British Young Driver of the Year, which again, it was the first time a female had been nominated. So I got a lot of attention. I attempted to do a year of Formula 3. I did two races and I broke my ankle. I lost the place in my seat. I lost the sponsor. But 8 months later, I was testing a Mercedes-Benz German touring car. And they say what's for you won't go by you in life. And I'm definitely incredibly lucky that I got the opportunity to test for Mercedes. But it was only ever supposed to be one season. But I grabbed the opportunity. I refused to let them make my car lighter. Maybe regret that sometimes now. That would have been a big helping hand. But I absolutely felt that I had to go in and race on my own merit and not be given a lighter car simply because I was a female. So I think that single-mindedness that I had was a big part of me, you know, making it into Formula One.
I don't know the story of how you broke your ankle.
Unfortunately, it wasn't a glamorous high-speed accident. I was out running in Scotland in the winter and I slipped on ice.
Ow.
Ouch.
Poor you. And how long did it take for you to be able to start running again?
running again a long time. I remember it being a real struggle to get my medical done, to get my race license back, because the doctor said you have to stand on the broken ankle, which I just about managed to do through the pain. And then he said, okay, now you need to jump for me. I thought, oh my goodness. So I just gritted my teeth and jumped and thought, is that enough? Can I drive now? Can I get my license? But it was a very tough time in my career, because I'd left university to focus on being a racing driver. I was struggling to pay the rent at the end of every month. I obviously lost my seat in Formula 3. But I'm a big believer in gut feelings, and something told me just keep going.
What were you reading at uni?
International business.
Was it a clear, easy decision for you to give that up? And how did the family react to that?
I remember sitting in the economics lecture. I just started the second year, and I had come back from a test, and I suddenly had this realization of, what am I doing here? I'm a sheep that's following the flock. I'm sitting here because everyone tells me I should be sitting here. I want to be a racing driver. I want to be a successful racing driver. So I walked out of the economics hall, called home, and luckily it was my dad that answered and not my mum. And I said, I want to leave. And he said, okay, I'll pick you up in the morning. And by that time, you got to have a plan. So 1 week later, I had a little Golf TDI full of my worldly belongings. I drove from Oban down to Silverstone, got the local paper, rented the room in a little old lady's house, got a job as a marshal at Silverstone. And that was it. I was fully focused on my dream of trying to make it in racing.
So that was the plan. So it's honestly, if mum had answered the phone.
Well, thankfully, I got invited back to Edinburgh University for an honorary degree. So my mum finally got my graduation picture to put on the kitchen wall.
That's a good...
But I do think my parents had reservations, but they supported me, and I'll always be thankful for that.
Just out of interest, we're going to come on to life now as Venturi Formula E boss, etc. But do you think that degree would have helped you in your life now?
No, I think life experience counts for a lot more. And when I jumped into my role as team principal, I had absolutely a lot to learn, and I was out of my depth, but I survived. And I'm a great believer in pushing yourself out of your comfort zone. I think studying, and I'm sorry for all the parents who are listening to this that are trying to tell their children that they've got to go to university and get a degree. I think if university buys you time to figure out what you want to do, but I don't think it's everything. I'm now trying to learn French. I'm doing some online Harvard courses to fill in the gaps where I feel that I need to have more knowledge. But I say, grab opportunities and go for them. Don't feel like it's not possible unless you have a university degree. And there was also an element of the financial side, to go and study for another 4 years and be later into the workforce is also quite a commitment, and the competition is high. So I think every case is different. Every individual has to do what's right for them. But for me, I don't regret for one second leaving university and chasing my dream.
Are you academic? Were you academic?
I'm very academic, just because I'm purely very competitive. I was the second highest in my year in the last year of school, not because I was the second brightest, but because I just put the work in, because I wanted to be the best. But I would say I'm academic in that I like reading, I like learning. I'm always open to learning new things and being more knowledgeable.
Susie, talk us through the move to Germany, to the German Touring Car Championship, the DTM Championship. How much of an upheaval was that? How difficult were those early years?
If I look back, it was a big change moving to Switzerland. I did the first race and I'd done quite well. I finished in the top 10, and Norbert Haug, my boss at the time, the Mercedes-Benz Motorsport boss, he took me to the side after the race, and bearing in mind I was on a one-year contract, he said, you've got the chance of a good future with us, but I give you one tip. Learn German and learn it fast. And within 3 months, I had learned German because my livelihood depended on it. But for sure, it was tough as a young girl moving to a German-speaking country and being in a very tough environment, which was DTM. But I never once felt that I couldn't handle it. I was treated very well by Mercedes-Benz, and it's obviously a relationship that's gone on over a lot of years now. But there were also great years, the traveling that we got to do and representing you know, one of the greatest automotive brands in the world, out on track and off track too, was a real honour.
Homesick?
Not at all. No, I'm a great believer in moving to a different country, experiencing another culture. It makes you grow so much as a person. And I'm incredibly lucky that my parents came to watch me racing. So I never felt that I was detached from home. On the contrary, I felt that it was great for my self-development.
And while racing the touring cars, was Formula One still the goal?
No, the goal was to make a living out of being a racing driver. I was very proud to race in the German touring cars, proud to be a Mercedes-Benz driver. And it only really after 5 years of relative little success in German touring cars that I started to think for my own mental well-being, I had to search for a different challenge. I was earning great money. I was in a great environment, but the success on track wasn't coming. And again, it was my gut feeling that started to say, you've got to look for another challenge now. And in some ways I needed some kind of success to validate my belief that I was a fast racing driver. And in DTM, there was flashes of, let's say, performance, but it was generally a tough, tough time. And there were some moments where I remember being mentally broken and just thinking, okay, how much more of this can I survive?
Mentally broken, just the lack of success, the frustration. Is that what you found so difficult?
So difficult, the non-performance on track, and the harder I tried, because I'd always believed that if you work hard enough, you can achieve what you want to achieve. And suddenly I was putting all my effort in. And when I look back in hindsight, I was putting too much effort in. I was completely, you know, overdriving and over-determined to prove myself. And I was then just in a vicious negative cycle.
How helpful were Mercedes in getting you to Williams and making the switch?
They weren't helpful because they didn't need to be helpful in that area. At the beginning of 2012, in May, I went to see Norbert Haug and I told him this would be my last season of DTM. And there was shock for them because obviously I was in a comfortable position. I was, like I said, earning great money, but I knew my time had come to an end. And at that moment, he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I just know I can't do this anymore. And I'm a great believer that the next door doesn't open until you've closed the door that you're currently, the room that you're currently in. And I knew I had to stop DTM to figure out what I was going to do next. And then, of course, the opportunity arose with Williams, but it was only ever supposed to be 20 laps around Silverstone because it was my dream to drive a Formula One car. It was never supposed to be anything more than that. But of course, it turned into a lot more than that. And when I look back, I was so brave to think that I was just going to stop DTM without knowing what I was going to do next. But my gut feeling said it's time to move on.
Did you pick up the phone to Frank? How did it work?
It all happened because obviously at the time in DTM, my teammates were David Coulthard, were Ralf Schumacher, who had been ex-Williams drivers. And it was actually because Toto joined Williams as an investor. And Toto came back from the first board meeting and said, Frank kept asking me about you, that he couldn't believe that there was a girl racing. Because in his day, obviously the women were in the paddock making the sandwiches and the tea, but certainly not in the car. And I found the story funny, but didn't think any more of it. And then we heard that Frank was coming to the DTM race at Brands Hatch to watch.
To watch you?
I don't think just to watch me. I think he was interested, obviously, to see this girl that was racing, but interested also to watch the DTM and see the racing. And I made it clear that obviously it was my goal to drive a Formula One car one day. And he said, you're going to drive my car. I'm going to give you the chance to drive my car. And that was it. It was set then for the winter that I would do 20 laps. I woke up on the day and saw that it had been raining and thought, oh no, it's going to be wet. But again, the team had done a great job of getting me ready for driving the car. And the test went really well and I probably did better than they expected. And then the idea came that, okay, you're going to join the team in a development driver capacity. And we invented that term, development driver. Now a lot of other teams have development drivers. And I think it's a great way to kind of nurture young talent. I wasn't that young at the time, but that really started the Formula One journey.
I remember there being so much attention around you at the time, particularly obviously 2014, which we've already talked about. How have you dealt with fame? How difficult do you find that?
I can't answer that question because I don't think I have fame. I don't at all feel famous. I do what I do. I obviously get recognition for what I achieved in the past and if I walk into a paddock, but otherwise I lead a completely normal life.
I look at Drive to Survive. That will have created yet more interest in Susie Wolf as well, the latest series.
Maybe created more interest, but in the end it's following what we do as our, let's say, jobs, as our careers. And I'm incredibly lucky to be on the journey together with Toto. He's had an incredible run in Formula One and I'm his biggest supporter, without a doubt. And we are very grateful to be able to do what we do and to be part of such a great team. But we have our feet firmly on the ground. And in the end, it's a time of our lives where we're riding a huge Formula One wave, but we won't be racing forever. And that's why we're enjoying it while we can. And I'm obviously, coming from a motorsport background, I love being at the racing and I love what he does and I love being part of the team. And that makes it much easier. It's really a lifestyle for our family.
How did you find the whole Drive to Survive experience, being interviewed? Do you like the end product? Because even now it's still being discussed with the drivers. Max Verstappen is quite outspoken about it, saying that he doesn't want to be part of it. What are your thoughts on it?
I think, first of all, we need to be respectful of the fact that it's done a great, great thing for Formula One in that it's opened Formula One up to a wider audience. I certainly see so many more young girls and women interested in the sport because of Drive to Survive. I think formerly, the sport was seen as something very technologically driven, whereas now there's this element of there being more human element to Formula One, which is great because there are characters and the drivers wear a helmet, so people don't get to see them a lot. Whereas in Drive to Survive, you see the challenges of being a Formula One driver. You see the pressure that these guys are under. So I think there's far more positives to come out of Drive to Survive than there are negatives. I can, let's say, understand the frustrations from certain people that the narrative had been spun in a different way. But in the end, we've got to be thankful as a whole that Drive to Survive has had a positive impact on the sport.
Yeah, it's definitely shed a light on a different side of the sport, isn't it? What about Lewis? You've known him for so long. Is he the same guy now that he was when you were karting together all those years ago?
He absolutely is. And I have no reservations in saying that. You know, just 2 days ago, we were reminiscing about something that had happened in the karting days that we had remembered. And if I haven't seen him for a while, the first thing he does is ask me how my parents are, John and Sally. And we reminisce a lot. I watched some of the races together with Anthony, his dad. And he's absolutely the same. But I just have so much admiration and respect for Lewis. What he's achieved, how he manages his life to be the best possible racing driver that he can be. And for me, which is incredible to watch, is just how deep he can dig in moments of pressure. And I didn't have that to that extent as a racing driver, but he has an incredible ability in the car and out of the car.
And would you say an incredible ability to move on as well? I'm referring to Abu Dhabi and the disappointment last year.
You know, I'm inspired by Lewis as a racing driver, but also as a human being. And obviously I see some of the negative comments around what he does and how vocal he is in different areas. But you know what? It takes guts to be different. And I know that to a lesser extent because I was different, always in the paddock. And it's easy to be the same as everyone else. It's easy just to rock up, race, leave and not worry. But he has the guts to be different, to stand up and to use his platform for other causes. And I think that's also got to be commended. Because the easier route is to do nothing. I think where he's at now and the determination he has and his ability off track to do what he does. And like you said, to move on. It takes a lot of strength to move on, but he has moved on and the whole team has moved on.
Let's talk a little more about life after racing for you. You retired in 2015 and Dare to Be Different was one of your, is it fair to say, one of your first ventures after racing? What was the motivation to start that? And of course, it's now morphed into the FIA's Girls on Track. Just tell us about why you set that up.
It was the first thing I did, and it was clear that I was going to do something. I wanted to give something back to the sport that had given me so much. And I wanted to pass the baton on to the next generation. I wanted them to learn from my mistakes, but also from my experience. And I wanted to inspire the next generation, because I'd spoken so much about being a woman in motorsport that I felt that together with Motorsport UK, we could do something to change the narrative. And I also felt there are so many people within the sport that say, we'd love to see more diversity, but nobody actually does anything. And in the end, actions speak much louder than words. And that's why I felt compelled to do something. And obviously it was about increasing participation, increasing the talent pool. I knew it would never have success overnight. It's a long-term project. And I'm very proud when I see what the FIA Girls on Track is achieving. And I have so many nice stories and messages from young women and girls who have been inspired by either attending one of our events or, let's say, being inspired by something they read online. And that for me is what gives me huge satisfaction and compels me to want to do even more.
And are you involved in the Hamilton Commission as well?
Not right now, because I'm quite busy running a Formula E team, but let's see what the future holds. I'm someone that definitely believes in giving back, and it's an area where I definitely want to do more in the future. So yeah, watch this space.
Right, come on then. Susie Wolf, team principal, team boss. What's the correct terminology? Are you both?
No, I've stepped, let's say, up from team principal, because the travel was quite challenging in my family dynamic of being a wife and a mother. So I'm now the CEO of the team, which means I don't need to attend all the races, but most of them.
How have you found the step into management? Is it easier than driving?
I'm incredibly lucky that I got to watch Toto over so many years running his team. And that was a huge inspiration for me to believe that I could do it. And he was very supportive when the opportunity came up. He said, go for it. You've got it in you. You've just got to believe in yourself. And there were some moments at the beginning where, you know, the team that I joined was at the back of the grid. There was a lot of issues in the team. And at times I thought, what have I taken on here? I've got a mountain to climb to get to where we need to be. But fast forward 3 years, we're currently leading both championships in Formula E, and we finished vice world champions last season. So it's been an incredible journey, and I've had the privilege of working with some really, really great people. But to answer your question, there was a lot to learn. I was in the deep end, but I believed I could do it.
What's been the hardest thing to get used to?
I think there's areas of the business where I had to learn a lot. There was a pile of contracts I had to work through, some which I had to get us out of, and some which I had to correct because they'd been done in the wrong way. So there was areas of the business. And then on the financial side, now obviously we have a financial cost cap also in Formula E, and that takes a huge amount of learning if you've never run a business before, to understand how to put the right structure in place and how to make sure you're managing the team for not just short-term success, but medium to long-term success. But one area I was very focused on initially is just getting the right people in the right positions and bringing the right energy into the team.
You say you learned a lot from Toto. What kind of stuff?
Where to start? I have a different management style to Toto because I'm a different character than Toto, and I don't try to copy what he does, but I am definitely inspired from how he runs the organization. He's very authentic. He's very, very good in his communication. And that's where he's got a lot of empathy for the people he works with. And he surrounds himself by very talented people. He's not scared to be challenged. And he wants bright people around him that do challenge him. And I think that's something which I definitely learned from having watched him over so many years. And it's one thing trying to be successful as a team and get to the front, but it's another thing trying to maintain that success. And they obviously had a huge challenge in that they'd won title after title, and how do you keep a group of individuals together and motivated? And that's been one of his great challenges. But I'm just inspired watching him, what he does. And I learn something every day, and I never stop learning, and I hope I never stop learning.
And you do beat him in Formula E occasionally, huh? That must feel very sweet.
I'm in the end, you know, there's 24 cars out there, and we as a team have the Mercedes-Benz power unit in our car, and it's they've done a fantastic job. So I don't focus on that rivalry. I'm very proud of him. I want him to be successful. He wants me to be successful. But of course, I'm in it to win it. And they're a competitor, but there's a good relationship. And I think to be successful, you need to focus on your own performance. You don't need to worry about the competition. You just need to focus on doing the best you can do. And if that's enough to win, great. And if it's not, how are you going to turn it around? And how are you going to make your organization and your team better?
Now, who's quicker, you or Toto?
Tom, how can you even ask that question? I made a career out of being a racing driver. I have to be quicker than Toto.
Sure. And we've seen the video as well, huh?
I have nothing to prove, by the way, anymore. So I'm fine jumping in a car and not having to show the world how good I am. But I would like to think I'm still quicker.
Just a little bit of off-track stuff. How do you relax? Is it all motor racing, your life, your chat? Do you have time for anything else?
We definitely do. And thankfully, my marriage is not just all about motorsport, because then we would be in quite a bad place. We're just, I think, completely normal. We enjoy spending time together as a family. I'm terrible in the kitchen. So if we want to eat nice food, we have to go out to eat nice food. But we enjoy traveling, experiencing different cultures and different environments, doing sport together. It can sometimes get very competitive, but we generally have found quite a good balance now after 10 years of marriage. But I think fundamentally we just focus on being content and happy. And if there's one thing that the whole pandemic taught us, happiness comes from the simple things in life. It's not about the big grand gestures or the big moments. It's the small daily things that you experience together, that you can do together, and when you're together as a family, that actually bring the most joy.
Something you said a little bit earlier about riding this Formula One wave together. I love that analogy. But when the wave breaks and runs in towards the shore, do you see yourself still in motorsport in 5, 10, 15 years' time?
Motorsport is where my life is right now. And when I talk of riding that wave, you know, we've won the World Championship 8 times, and I've certainly felt over the last couple of seasons that there's, let's say, a gathering momentum of people saying they got to stop now. You know, it's too much. And I understand that. I think in any sport, you don't want to see the same person winning all the time. So I definitely have an understanding for that perspective. But in the end, we're in it, and we're always going to try and do the best we can. I see Toto and myself always being involved in the Formula One team. Obviously, there's a shareholding in the team, but it's something we are hugely passionate about. So I don't ever see us just leaving. Absolutely not. Like Toto said many times, everyone's got their shelf life. And you've got to also know when your time's up and move on and let the next generation through. And that's something we discuss quite often. But right now, you know, we've not got a car that's quick enough this season. We love the challenge of getting back there, and we're still 100% focused.
Susie, I just wanted to end by, you know, we came in talking about your Formula One experiences with Williams. And my last question is simply about the future for a talented female driver. Do you think that person has a better chance of getting a race seat in F1 today than just 5 years ago?
Yes. And I'm very, very pleased that I can say yes. But I do believe, because of the shift in society where diversity and inclusion has become a much bigger topic, it's not something that people can shy away from anymore. I think there's a real willingness to now see a female become successful on track. We've got to also remember that Formula One is the pinnacle of the sport. It won't happen overnight, but I do believe, for all the young girls out there who are racing, keep going. Because aside from Formula One, there's so many opportunities out there now, much more than before. And if you are good enough, you will find an opportunity. Focus on the performance, because performance is power.
I can't think of anyone better than Susie to lead F1 Academy. With all the F1 teams backing the series and the exposure it will receive at Grand Prix weekends, 2024 is a momentous opportunity, and I can't wait to see what a success it's going to become. I'm hoping I'll get another chance to speak to Susie on F1 Beyond the Grid this year to talk through all things F1 Academy. And you can keep up with all the latest F1 Academy news at f1academy.com and at F1 Academy on social media. Keep up with the latest F1 action on F1 Nation.
A superb finish to the line!
Race previews, post-race insights, and exclusive interviews from the heart of the F1 paddock.
Magnificent team effort all round.
Huge win for us today.
And we're pushing at the limit.
We must have just got something wrong.
Oscar, can we just grab you on the way out?
A very, very cool day. It's been a weekend to remember.
You'll hear from the drivers, team principals, engineers, and F1 experts from around the world.
Really, really nice to feel that atmosphere there in the garage.
Having the two of them in the points, quite impressive.
Those next few positions are worth millions of dollars.
The combination is unbeatable.
New episodes every Monday. Search your podcast app for F1 Nation.